Presented by two individuals, both from UC Berkeley. And this is Sylvia Gwendolman, who's professor at UC Berkeley, and her co-author, Laura Satchel, who's doctor and DRPH candidate at UC Berkeley. And they're going to be talking about infertility status and fertility treatment and the relationship to racial and ethnic disparities. And we're going to reserve questions to the end. We're going to have a discussant speak for about 5 to 10 minutes, his reflections on these papers, and then we'll have questions.
Good morning. Glad to be here. And this has been a really interesting experience to collaborate on a chapter that we feel is part of the elephant, and the elephant is this big book that's coming out, which we hope will give us a lot more sense of what's happening with all these different technologies that we use and how they affect racial, ethnic differences. And our presentation focuses on infertility. You're using the road. Okay. So a little bit of background here. We did our review of the literature, found that research focusing on racial and ethnic disparities in infertility and its treatment is really research that here in the U.S. is just beginning to emerge. And we consider it a really important kind of research because infertility status, access to infertility care, and responses to medical treatment are not distributed evenly among women. We know that, and in fact, research begins to suggest that there are important, notable differences across ethnic and racial groups. So the aim of our presentation today is to really compare racial ethnic differences in prevalence of infertility, utilization of infertility services, and response to one very costly high-tech infertility treatment, which is in vitro fertilization. So let's start with some common definitions. The definition that is used in the field of infertility is one that is being used also by the National Study of Family Growth, which defines infertility as this inability to conceive following unprotected sexual intercourse for 12 or more consecutive months. In the National Study of Family Growth, only infertile women or only married women within the ages of 15 to 44 are considered, and it excludes women who've had some surgical sterility. Here you have the prevalence rates according to this national study, and as you can see, black women experience much higher rates of infertility. The National Study of Family Growth also uses another definition of infertility referred to as impaired fecundity, which is a broader definition, and this includes the inability to conceive or carry a pregnancy to term over a 3-year period. For this definition, both married and unmarried women are included, but it also, as before, excludes women with surgical sterility. So overall, what we can tell you is that population-based estimates of medical conditions causing infertility are quite difficult to ascertain, not only because you're dealing here with different definitions, but our sources for the population-based studies come from two sources, either population studies or infertility clinic data. The challenges in estimating prevalence and cause from population studies is that, number one, they're based on self-reports and they're not medically verified, and this requires some awareness or use of infertility treatment by women. And as I explained before, oftentimes, depending on the definition that you use, unmarried women might be missed. On the other hand, you've got the infertility clinic data, and those have the advantage that they're medically verified, But we do know that there's lots of selection bias involved in people who use these infertility clinics. By and large, women who use these clinics tend to be insured and have higher income and education. In terms of causes of infertility, as you can see, they're pretty much distributed evenly among female and male factors. Because of lack of time, we won't enter into what those causes are specifically. But just for you to be able to know that about 12% of women seek infertility care or infertility services in the U.S. And as you can see again, whether you look at whether women ever used a treatment or women with current fertility problems use a treatment, again, white women seem to be using infertility services disproportionately more. So let's look now at some barriers to care. And as you probably now must surmise, financial constraints are one of the largest, if not the biggest, barrier to care. These infertility services are very expensive. And then you've got the issue of insurance. Although there have been some state mandates to try and regulate infertility services such that private insurance plans cover this, still, in several states, that is not the case. And we know also that infertility services are rarely covered by Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California. There are also cultural barriers. In some minority communities, we know that there's quite a bit of distrust of the medical community. There are also religious beliefs in some other communities that say, well, you don't tinker with infertility services. In other cases, particularly, there have been some anthropological studies suggesting that in some African American communities, there is an ethos that would encourage adoption, given that so many children are available for adoption, rather than focus on infertility care. And then we also find among cultural barriers that the fear of receiving infertility treatment has to sort of then lead to an acceptance, and some women prefer to remain in the denial stage, or they have to work through the shame of feeling that they might be infertile, or the fear of that. And I would say that although this presentation is focusing predominantly on women, because that's where we have most of the data for, probably some of these factors also would involve the male partners. Informational barriers are other barriers, because oftentimes women don't really understand or know when to get timely diagnosis or treatment for this type of situation. And then you've got the motivational factors, that is, in the case of particularly secondary infertility, where you've had a child already but then become infertile, there's oftentimes less interest in pursuing these difficult treatments that might be involved. And finally, you've got barriers related to provider attitudes, knowledge, and behavior. We know that some providers, particularly if they're dealing with low-income women, prefer not to refer them because they don't think that they will be seen anywhere or accepted for treatment. And then there's some refusal on some providers to treat subgroups, and the literature discusses gay and lesbians as one group which is particularly targeted for a lot of this stigma.
So if you look at some of the causes of infertility, you can see that there are multiple different parts of the female reproductive system and the male reproductive system that can be involved in infertility. And treatment is really directed to specifically which causes is affecting the infertility. So if a woman were to have an ovulatory problem, for example, treatment would be directed towards giving medication to try and induce more eggs to develop on a given cycle. If there's a male factor problem, for example, inadequate sperm production or quality of sperm, there are treatments directed towards trying to enhance the quality of sperm and to try and to do direct insemination where sperm is directly placed inside the uterus. The treatment that we really looked at for our evaluation most specifically is in vitro fertilization. And in vitro fertilization is certainly the most costly treatment, both financially and probably emotionally as well. In 2003, the average cost was $12,400, and the costs have been continuing to climb since that time. The thing that made this an appealing treatment to evaluate is that the data is actually standardized, because there was a law passed in 1992 that required fertility clinics to report their data in a standardized fashion. So as opposed to the different treatments that I had on the slide before, this is the only treatment where there is data available on a national level. Unfortunately, there's very little data on racial and ethnic disparities on any of the other treatments. But we also felt that in vitro fertilization had the widest public health implications. Why? Well, about half of the births resulting from in vitro fertilization are actually multifetal pregnancies. That's twins, triplets, and beyond. And these have increased risks both for the mother in terms of conditions like preeclampsia, preterm labor, and a higher risk of surgical delivery, as well as risks for infants with much higher rates for preterm deliveries and low birth weight, which have immediate sequelae as well as an increased risk of neonatal death, actually a fourfold increase in neonatal death of infants born from this technology. The costs are also substantial. Even if insurance is unwilling to cover infertility treatments, very often it is insurances that bear the burden of caring for twins and triplets that are born as a result of these procedures. And there also appears to be a higher chance for structural and chromosomal abnormalities in the offspring of women who have had these treatments. If you look at the stages involved in vitro fertilization, it begins on the left with medication to try and enhance the number of eggs that are produced on a given cycle. And then using an ultrasound to guide a needle, eggs are actually withdrawn from the ovary, brought into a test tube, and then mixed with semen that's been collected from a male partner and utilized to try and encourage fertilization. If fertilization is successful and incubation results in an embryo, the embryo is then transferred back inside the uterus. If that process is successful, it results in a clinical pregnancy, one that can be identified using an ultrasound. However, only a portion of these go on to result in a live birth. Actually, what I want to mention is that only about 27% of cycles that are initiated result in a live birth. The response to in vitro fertilization varies with a number of factors. Factors that are involving the woman, such as her age and how long she's been infertile, what her diagnosis is, and whether this is her first attempt at in vitro fertilization or a subsequent cycle, as well as characteristics of the cycle itself, how many embryos are being transferred, whether or not the embryo is fresh or whether they've used a frozen embryo, and whether they use donor eggs or not. But the question we were interested in is, does the response also vary by race and ethnicity? So here's the questions that we sought out to answer. One is, how do patients who are seeking in vitro fertilization compare when they're coming from different racial and ethnic groups? And secondly, do the clinical pregnancy and the live birth rates resulting from IVF vary by race and ethnicity? We scoured the literature using several search engines. We were able to identify 11 studies that could help us answer these questions. And we were interested only in looking at cycles where fresh eggs were used and where they didn't involve the use of donor eggs. As far as people showing up for infertility care for in vitro fertilization, I'm going to present the data looking at different racial ethnic groups separately. So when comparing blacks and whites, it's noted that black women seeking IVF tend to have a higher body mass index and tend to arrive for care after a longer duration of infertility. Their diagnosis seems to also be different than that of their white counterparts. There's a much higher rate of tubal factor infertility. Probably 60 to 70% of women showing up for IVF have this as their primary diagnosis, compared to only about 30% of white women. Also higher rates of fibroids and a higher rate of miscarriage, meaning even once they get to the clinical pregnancy stage, they are less likely to achieve a live birth. Whites, on the other hand, have higher rates of male factor infertility, endometriosis, and problems with ovulation. there's basically a handful of studies that were reports from specific IVF centers that were trying to compare blacks and whites and the IVF response rates. And what you can see here is that the results were very inconsistent. Sometimes blacks had lower success rates, one study showed higher rates, and many failed to show differences. However, these studies failed to really control for a lot of the factors that we know impact IVF response. The largest data set was based on a national data set, which is from the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology. And you can see here they had 68,000 cycles for whites and over 3,000 for blacks. With this much more comprehensive database, it appears that blacks have lower live birth rates. And a subsequent study on the same data set showed that even when there were multiple factors controlled, such as maternal age, parity, certain hormonal characteristics, how many embryos were being transferred, this still did not fail to result in a lower live birth rate for blacks. So it seems that our best data suggests that there is a poorer response rate for black women undergoing IVF. The data on Hispanics is actually even more scanty. There's only two studies that reported on outcomes. Both of these showed that there were no difference in clinical pregnancy and live birth rates when comparing white non-Hispanics with Hispanics. And also only two studies that looked at Asians. Both of these studies, however, did show lower live birth rates, substantially lower, like 30% lower live birth rates for Asians, even when controlling for multiple other factors using multivariate analysis. So in conclusion, we've tried to share with you that infertility appears to be higher among minorities. However, the utilization of services is lower in minorities compared to non-Hispanic whites. And I've also shared with you that whites may have better outcomes than studies that have looked at Asians and blacks comparing them to whites. One of the things that concerns us is that the greater utilization of in vitro fertilization by non-Hispanic whites may mean that this group is going to be having a higher rate of high-risk pregnancies. They're having more of the twins and the triplets and the poor outcomes. And so ironically, this may inadvertently narrow racial disparities in low birth weight and preterm birth, because we're having more white women promoting high-risk deliveries. Our recommendations as far as sort of public health for public health practitioners, one is that this is a field really ripe for research. There needs to be more data collection in the area of racial ethnic disparities, and not even just in these large global categories like Hispanic or Asian, but in subgroups as well, to see when we disaggregate the data, how are different subgroups doing. And we really think that infertility clinics should be encouraged to be collecting data on race, ethnicity, as well as socioeconomic status, insurance, and as well as responses to multiple treatments, not only in vitro fertilization. We also think there's a real role for health promotion and education. I mentioned to you the high rate of tubal infertility in African American women. Well, this largely results from the higher rates of sexually transmitted infection in this group. And so there should even be heightened efforts to reduce sexually transmitted disease in minority patients to try and avoid infertility in the first place. It also gives us an additional reason to encourage optimal body weight, because overweight individuals have a poorer response to all of these treatments. And we think there should be further education to try and let women know that there are consequences of delaying childbearing, and that it may be much more difficult to have an adequate response to treatment if women postpone childbearing many years. And there should also be a better effort to identify women who are infertile early and to try and get appropriate referrals for care, because many of the studies show, particularly for minority patients, that they really had suffered infertility much longer than their white counterparts before they got treatment. And finally, there's a role for policy and advocacy. In order to promote better equity, we should consider trying to have better insurance coverage so that infertility services really can be available to everyone. In the Department of Defense study, where infertility care was available to all groups equally, it appeared that black women did utilize services at the same rate as their white counterparts. And finally, in an effort to try and lower these high-risk deliveries, we should consider the promotion of single embryo transfer. Rather than trying to up the response by putting lots of embryos in the uterus, if we try and encourage practitioners to only do one embryo, there's not a risk of having these multiple births. And this is being encouraged in other countries where there is insurance coverage, but it's something that we should consider promoting in this country as well. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for sticking to the times. I haven't had to use my five-minute warning sheet yet. Okay, and our last presentation before we have our discussant is Susan Vonder.